Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Joe's Weather World, your only weather podcast dedicated to Kansas City.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Joe's Weather World. And part one of our podcast, or the most recent podcast we did, was talking to a professor from UMKC about climate change and how things are evolving locally, regionally, nationally, globally, and some of the reasons why that's all happening. We kind of covered greenhouse gases and a few other more, for lack of a better phrase, simplistic things so that you can kind of get your mind around what is causing the situation that we're kind of gradually evolving into from a climate standpoint. We're going to get into a few other things now. I've got a professor from UMKC joining me on this particular podcast, and he's been kind enough to stick around and help me out with part two. This is Professor Adegoke. Yes, two in a row, who's helping us out with this. So if you want the more basic stuff, and we'll kind of cover some of the basic stuff again, listen to part one. This particular podcast will dive deeper into things. And at the end of our most recent podcast, we were talking about the greenhouse effect and ways that that's kind of manifesting itself right now. I want to kind of dive a little bit more into this because we also talked about how the world for eons, ever since it was created, has been going through natural changes, warm cycles, cold cycles, and stuff like that. But what's separating this particular time period, and we're talking decades now as opposed to hundreds of millions of years, is that the acceleration that we're seeing in the changing climate is accelerating beyond what natural variability would dictate. And that's what we're kind of diving into now. So once again, Professor, thank you for joining us. And so let's kind of get into this. How do we know, maybe we'll do a little recap here, how do we know that this is not natural variability? And how do we know that we were not predestined to be going down the path that we're going down now?
Yeah. Well, measurements, you know. That's you know, that's the beauty of science, data, right?
Right.
You know, so you know, just temperature measurements over the last 50 years or so. This is actual data. You know, if we compare that, we started taking measurements in the U.S. here in 1895. So we have about 100 years of actual, 100 plus years.
Right. Which sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
But again, I'm very sensitive to what's referred to as POR, period of record.
Yeah.
And yeah, 100 years is a big deal. I mean, that's good, but it's just a speck of time.
Yeah.
When you look at, you know, how long humanity has been around, how long the Earth has existed. Yeah. So in a weird sense, it really is just a speck of time. And what I'm almost more fascinated by, especially because this is a whole nother thing I wanted to kind of get into, is data acquisition.
Yeah.
Is, all right, so we've had thermometers since, 1700s when
That's
Fahrenheit
right.
scale was invented, Celsius. You know, you could take a thermometer and they're manufactured and sometimes they're perfect, sometimes they're a little off. Just weird things happen, I think, sometimes with thermometers. Satellite measurement, though, fascinates me.
Yes, and we've had those from about the 1960s.
Since the 1960s. Yeah. So how do we know, See, I'm already going down a tangent. How do we know that those data sets are the data set that you might have from 1975 compared to the data set that you might have now from, let's just say, 2015, 40-year difference? How do you know that those two data sets merge up very well together? In other words, hey, was there a problem with the sensor? We've got a much better sensor now. How do we make that comparison?
Well, that's a valid question. That's a valid question. But there's an entire science called around what we call data homogenization or something like that. You know, and it takes into account, you know, changes, you know, in technology, changes in you know, measurement styles, you know. So the record that we have, say, over the last 100 years, say, for instance, it's a fairly consistent record that shows us quite a bit of science goes into it. Just the data, you know, the curating that data and managing that data in itself. So I think that it's safe to say that there's a lot of we can have a lot of confidence in the data in the data archives that we have around temperature, around a whole range of other sources. But beyond this 100-year period, when we've actually plus years when we built the U.S.
climate network.
Science has always, and this is really quite recent. This just developed, I would say, in the last 20, 30 years, have been a quantum leap in ability to access other data sources, especially ice core data, three ring data, you know. And these have enabled us to extend, you know, our understanding of climate variability and changing climate back several thousands of years, actually,
using
these really interesting, sophisticated methods, you know, through this whole science called paleoclimatology.
And this is where I'm fascinated by, and in all honesty, I don't understand this as fully, but when you look at ice cores, especially, you could essentially, if you don't know what an ice core is, you could go up to a glacier, whatever, drill down, take out a large tube of ice, and essentially track it back. I don't know if you could go by the year, but
every year.
You can go by
the year. Yeah, because there is a record. Every year when you have snowfall, the snow that falls and compacts.
And compacts.
Compacts along with it the record of the gases in the atmosphere, you know. And in science, they've been able to develop some really interesting scientific methods of analyzing the ratio of oxygen, the ratio of this, and in comparison to, you know, different ratios, actually. And that can be backed out into, you know, we can back out temperature information from that as well. It's some really sophisticated science. I am not a paleoclimatologist. I would give that to, to you.
Since the whole, can't give it to me.
It's a whole new. It's a whole different area of science. Larger, and we do have, in fact, on staff at UMKC, at least one paleoclimatologist.
Really?
Who does? She does more. Dr. Molly Davis, who runs our environmental science program. She runs the paleoclimate lab. Most of her work is using lake sediment data, actually. Lake sediment data, so she cores, lakes around the world, you know, and able to back out really interesting, useful information about past climate from, you know, lake sediments as well. So there are a range of data sources like this and techniques that are available. But I would certainly, if you want to dig a little bit further into this area of past climate and how we know what we know about past climates. I would say Dr. Davis is the expert in you know, probably one of the best persons around here to address that question.
That could be another climate podcast has just possibly come up down the road. So, Well, we get an idea about whether it by tree rings, especially from a precipitation standpoint, I would imagine on tree rings and stuff like that, is we get an idea what did occur 200 years ago, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, 1,000 years ago.
Correct.
And so now all of a sudden, instead of looking at the last 20 or 30 years of weather information, climate history, now we could broaden that out just a little bit. The reason why I wanted to kind of circulate around to that is a lot of what climate change, how to properly phrase this, a lot of what we talk about in terms of the future.
Yes.
Is based on climate models.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, this is where I've got my thought process gets a little jumbled on this, and I absolutely acknowledge the fact that I'm looking at this probably not in the right direction. But as a person who uses weather models on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. and as somebody who will, as a viewer will say to me, well, you know, your weather models weren't right 5 days from now. How the heck do they know what's going to happen 20 years from now?
Yeah.
And it's sometimes a discussion path that I feel challenged with. They're different models.
Yeah.
They're based on different things.
Yes.
And they're not meant to be as specific, I guess, for a local area.
Correct.
But How do you resolve that?
Yeah. Well, that's a really great question, Joe, and this falls right in right in my wheelhouse.
Okay.
You know, a lot of the work that I've done, I've used very sophisticated climate models to address into the research and come up with. The kinds of results that we have. Those concerns are very valid. They're very valid. And that's why there is no climate scientist that is worth his name, that will tell you that this results about 2030 or about 2100. 100 years, 60 years, or, into the future, that is a prediction. No, we do not make predictions about the future because we cannot, in fact, make predictions about the future. What we provide is what we call a projection. So we use the best of the science that we know now. We make certain assumptions about that science, and we say that within this range of assumptions, we project that if A, B, and C remains constant, or if it changes within a certain envelope, mm-hmm. this is what you're going to project. This is what we project will happen, 20, 50, 100 years into the future. We also, around each of this, there's a sense of what the uncertainties are. Every person who uses climate models will tell you, that we make a number of subjective decisions, about just to get the model to even run,
Interesting.
And that's why even those projections are not based on a single model. So, I have on the table here right now what we call the Fourth National Climate Assessment. This was just completed. Congress mandates several government agencies. NOAA is the lead. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric mm-hmm. Administration. It's part of the Department of Commerce. So Weather Service is part of NOAA. All right. Mandates a bunch of federal agencies under what is called the U.S. Global Change Research Program to do an assessment of climate, the current climate, and make projections into the future.
Where we may be going.
Every 4 years.
Okay.
The last one was just completed and released last year, towards the end of last year. And there are usually, in this assessment, we have used at least 30 different climate models, you know. And so when we make a projection within a certain about a particular climate variable, you know, it's really it's a synthesis in some ways, you know, of the best information that has come out of these different models, you know. So that sort of increases our confidence in the results, but it doesn't still it doesn't imply that those are exact predictions about the future. I don't know if that helps, but yeah, that's the way we'll address this.
It helps a little bit. I think what we do sometimes in the world of weather, and we talked in part one about the difference between weather and climate. Weather, at its most basic, is like one pitch of a baseball game.
Correct.
Climate is like a whole season. That would be one way of looking at it, I guess, in a baseball metaphor. So in the world of weather, what we do is when we're changing models, upgrading models, creating new models, we have the ability of going back and looking at, hey, let's see how the model would have done with, for example, Superstorm Sandy, or, you know, inputting the information from days from, I don't know, 2 years ago leading up to whatever big weather event occurred, and let's see how that model performed in that type of situation. Can you do that with climate models? Can you look back at the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, input that information into the model, see what the model spits out for 2010, 2020, 2030, and see how the model is performing? Is that a fair
In fact,
test?
That's exactly what we do. You're speaking just like a climate modeler right now, because that's exactly what we do. So you, when in trying to do a climate model prediction or run for the future, you know, you first of all do an assessment of the model itself. How well does this model replicate current climate? Right. So you look back, maybe, you know, use data sets from 20, 25 years ago. You run that model 25 years into the future to today. And then you look at, you know, use the output of the model against actual data to sort of do your model assessment, you know. And that gives you some measure of confidence whether you could in fact even use this in any way to make projections into the future. Now, there's something that I think we need to sort of lay out here. Your job of predicting what's going to happen in the next 3, 4, 5 days is a lot more difficult than my job for predicting what's going to happen 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Now, why do you say that?
Yeah, because...
By the way, thank
chaos.
You. But why do you say that?
Because the chaos factor in the atmospheric, in the climate system, you know, you're dealing with a really chaotic system, you know, on a per second basis, really. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what you need to, and that's all captured within, you know, short-term weather forecasting, you know, because you're dealing with actual weather changes in the weather as and the dynamic aspects of those changes as they occur, you know. And a lot of it is just, it's just really unpredictable. You know,
right.
It's beyond our the space of predictability. You know, and yet your mandate is actually to give us a prediction.
Right.
You know, but once when we're looking 20 years into the future, 30 years into the future, a lot of that chaos is smoothed out. It's sort of evened out. You know,
is so that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
It's a good thing from a science point of view.
Right.
Because it makes the job a little easier, you know, and it makes us it makes it a little easier to be able to have confidence in what you're doing, you know. I don't know,
yeah.
But that's one point that sort of eludes or evades a number of people.
So when you look at how the climate models have taken in this data from 20, 30 years ago, forecasting where we are now.
Yes.
Are you noticing any trends in the model data? Are the models doing well? Are the models underperforming, underestimating the rate of warming? Are the models overestimating the rate of warming?
And that's why we end up with an ensemble, right? Ensemble is this average of this.
Big
this
fan
model.
Of ensemble.
Some of them will overestimate. Some of them will underestimate. And some you have to throw out because they just do not. They're not really good at what you want to do. You know, the other thing is that certain models are good for certain things. You know, so the Hadley cell model, for instance, may be good at, you know, capturing easterly waves and a whole bunch of stuff that happens in the tropical systems, you know, and the NOAA model, for instance, that we run here, one of weather systems here, our models here, may not be that good in capturing that. So at the end of the day, you make a subjective decision as to, okay, this model does really well over the United States, for instance. It doesn't do as well in Japan, you know, partly because, the science, the parameterizations, right? You know, parameterizations are, you know, the equations that we have developed to sort of represent physical processes. You know, we have studied the U.S. system a lot more.
Correct.
We know a lot more about those, so we're able to represent those better in the equations that are captured in those models. And so they perform better over the U.S., but they may not in other parts of the world. So you make some subjective decisions as to, okay, this is my goal, this is what I want to do, and this set of models perform better over this domain, and you go with those.
And would that as well dovetail into certain models perform better over land masses as opposed to ocean scenarios?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So this is a whole, this could almost be worthy of a whole nother podcast, which we're probably running out of time for, but there, at least to me, seems to be very little doubt, no doubt really, how our rate of climate change now is affecting oceanic areas. Mm-hmm. Especially when I just anecdotally look at what's going on in the northern latitudes, what's going on up in the seas, the Arctic area around Alaska, how they're losing their ice at a ridiculous rate and they're not rebuilding that ice. And right now, northern Alaska, still ice-free. And it's virtually dark there now almost the whole time of the year. So what are we seeing from an oceanic standpoint in terms of, I'm trying to get around to, the ocean is essentially right now trapping,
heat.
Absorbing a lot of heat.
Correct.
And if it wasn't for the ocean, we'd probably see bigger effects on land.
Yeah.
So now, what's going on with the ocean?
Yeah. I think it's a question of sensitivity.
Right.
You know, so there are, so if you take coral reefs, for instance, you know, so there's a lot of discussion, a lot of, it's in the media about
dying
but
coral.
That's just because those are that particular environment, you know, physical environment is an extremely sensitive environment to even slight changes, you know, in temperature, you know. So it becomes, those changes becomes really pronounced and evident there. Same thing with the high latitudes, you know. Just because those environments, tend to be very highly sensitive to temperature changes. And those temperature changes produce effects that are really pronounced. And over time.
Yeah. And that part of it is, I find, fascinating because, and we may have seen it during the month of October, if you want to just break it down into a weather standpoint, where this reduced sea ice up off the coast of Alaska, north of Alaska. It's keeping that area unseasonably, I don't want to use the word warm, but higher than average for that part of the world.
Yes.
And when part of the yin and yang of driving this back into weather, part of the yin and yang of weather is when they're warm, we get cold typically here in the middle part of the country during fall, winter. And we may have been seeing that play out during the month of October. Because when you look at the globe and you look at temperatures compared to average just for 1 month, and 1 month is not climate, but you see this big, huge, anomalous cold pocket in the central plains through the Rockies up into parts of Canada, and you see Alaska being so warm. And this has been something that we've seen off and on for a couple of years, several years now. And I think we're seeing it maybe sort of starting to play out. If there's no ice up there and they're, by comparison, warmer, that cold air has to get released somehow. And maybe we're seeing that play out now.
Well, you put your finger on something really, really, really critical, Joe. The Earth is, what, 70% water, right? So most of, is it 70-something percent, you know, it's just water. So most of the Earth is really water. You know, this ocean is this large ocean basins, right? And if you couple that with our understanding, what we know, you know, I'm not going to talk baroclinic waves here and you know, all that stuff. But I'm going to say, though, that the climate system is connected, you know. And so what happens in the global oceans, whether it's the Pacific or the North Atlantic, it's intimately linked to what how the atmosphere responds one way or another. You know, so folks here in the U.S., for instance, they know about El Nino.
Right.
They would have heard about it, El Nino. That is an ocean process. It's a ocean. That whole thing, you know, it's the East and the West Pacific. You know, changes in temperature and sea surface temperature and sea surface pressure. That is what results in that really important. What we call teleconnection or remote impacts on climate in the U.S. and in fact beyond the U.S. You know, folks might find it difficult to believe, but when you have an El Nino happening here in the Pacific, you would have drought happening in Namibia. In South Africa, you know, how the heck does that happen?
Right.
That's because our global system
very interconnected.
Is interconnected.
Yeah.
So what you're referring to now is exactly part of that. This is not the El Nino now, but this is the North Atlantic oscillation, you know, and that has a direct effect on. So someone might be saying, hey, we don't really care about what's happening up there. Let the Alaskans worry about the water. Well, you better care because it could affect those cold outbreaks that we affect here and that sends us into these deep periods of,
of cold weather.
Winter weather.
Well, how can there could be global warming, climate change?
Yeah.
It's so cold outside. Well, no. Well, yes, it is cold outside, but the reason why it's cold outside is because of possibly what's happening in other parts of the world, other parts of our very own country, when you know, certainly have to include Alaska.
Correct.
In that, in the Arctic region and stuff like that. All right, so there are like 18,000 other questions we could discuss, but I think we're going to have to just stop because I've got to put together a weathercast for the newscast tonight. I want to thank Jimmy for helping us out, professor at UMKC. We may pull him back in here somewhere down the road so that I could kind of go through some more of this stuff. This is the first guest I've ever had that I've written out questions on, and I had like 20 questions and I asked him about four. So we kind of got into a lot of stuff here, but I want to thank you for listening to Joe's Weather World Part 2 of our climate change discussion, and we'll dive more into how the weather is changing, how the climate is changing in coming podcasts. But if you haven't listened to part one, listen to part one, then follow up with this particular one, and you'll get kind of get an idea, a sense of what we're looking at, what we kind of know, and to some extent, what we don't know in terms of how things are going to be changing and how things are changing, whether it be now or 50 years from now. Again, thanks so much for listening to Joe's Weather World. Jimmy, thank you.
Pleasure.
For dropping on by. And with that, have a great day.